Welcome to Fontanelle, the podcast with a soft spot for paediatrics. I'm Caroline Story, a paediatric trainee in Wessex, and I'm here at the Dorset County Hospital with Dr. Phil Parslow in the Penguin Pad. Phil is a consultant paediatrician with an interest in nephrology, and he's going to talk to us today about UTIs. We'll cover diagnosis and management in both primary and secondary care settings, making use of resources such as Healthier Together and the NICE guidelines. I hope you enjoy it, and I'm sure you're going to find it useful. So, over to Phil, and let's start by talking about the importance of making the right diagnosis.
Yeah, I think, as with lots of things in paediatrics, diagnosis of UTIs in children is important. And it's important that you think about it, because otherwise you're going to overlook it and miss it. And I think that's one of the key elements, that if you don't have UTI in your differential diagnosis, then you're going to miss it, particularly on the younger children. Mm-hmm. We know from kind of studies that about 3% of girls and about 1% of boys will have a symptomatic UTI before they're 11 years of age. So it's relatively common. Mm-hmm. We also know that it's important because UTIs will potentially damage developing kidneys and can cause long-term problems, either increasing the risk of hypertension as children get older, or if it's bilateral, then potentially causing chronic renal impairment. Mm. So it's really important that we get the right diagnosis. At the same time, it's important that we make a positive diagnosis of UTI where there is a UTI, but we also exclude it when there's not a UTI. And we're not treating children for something that they don't have, and therefore subjecting them to unnecessary antibiotics, unnecessary scans, but also missing whatever underlying diagnosis they do have and delaying the appropriate management of that.
Okay, so just stepping back a bit, how would a child with a UTI generally present?
So that's a really good question, and I think older children, it's a bit easier because they present with more localising signs. Mm-hmm. So they might present with some dysuria, some frequency. They might start wetting, whereas previously they've been dry. They might have some loin pain, some blood in the wee. So things that point the doctor towards the renal tract being the area of interest.
Yeah.
Obviously in younger children, you don't have those localising signs, so it's more generic. It's fever, it's vomiting, it's off feeds, it's you're kind of generally being unwell, but nothing that specifically points towards the urinary tract. And that's one of the key things, that you need to have UTIs in your differential diagnoses of fever. Otherwise you'll miss it.
So you've really got to look out for it.
And if you look at the Healthier Together fever pathways, if you look at the NICE febrile child pathways, one of the tests, or the only tests that they recommend for children that are green on the traffic light system, is a urine sample, because unless you get a urine sample, you're going to miss the UTI. So it's important that in febrile children, and the NICE UTI guideline says, you know, in a febrile child without an obvious focus of infection, it's essential to do a urine sample.
And that can actually be quite a difficult thing to get, can't it? It can be really frustrating. You can just see mum sitting there with the baby and hobbling
and added difficulty if you're in primary care or in an out-of-hours GP service, where you've not got the same time. You know, we're slightly lucky on paediatric assessment units and paediatric wards that we've got the space and the time for parents to be able to catch a urine sample, but that's harder in primary care.
Yeah. So how do we go about getting a urine sample then?
So there are different methods of collecting urine samples. In the olden days, we used to use things like plastic bags taped over a child's genitalia, or pads, absorbent pads within the nappy, to try and get urine samples that way. That's okay as a screening method, but there's a high chance of contamination with those methods. And actually what you're doing then is just delaying getting a decent sample and a diagnosis, really. So whilst they sometimes have their place, actually we certainly in Dorchester, and I think most paediatrics units now, prefer trying to get a clean catch mm-hmm. urine sample, and that does involve cleaning the child's genitalia and getting parents to sit with them over a pot and waiting until they wee. Mm-hmm. And there's various different kind of methods that you can read about in terms of putting saline soap gauze on the bladder or tapping the bladder or turning the taps on. But mm-hmm. in my experience, there's a certain amount of persistence and luck involved in getting those samples. Mm-hmm. But clearly, if you've got a very sick child, you haven't got the time to wait for a clean catch urine sample. Mm-hmm. And so then you need to think of more invasive ways of getting that urine sample, and options would either be a catheter sample mm-hmm. or a suprapubic aspiration. Mm-hmm. I think most units prefer catheters. Mm-hmm. I think ideally with suprapubics, you should do those under ultrasound guidance to prove that you're going into the right body space. And there's always difficulty in getting an ultrasound machine or somebody that's able to interpret the images that you're getting. So I think for that reason, most places, if you need to get a urine sample, for example, on your septic baby, mm-hmm. then an in-out catheter is the best way of doing that. And obviously, when you're doing this, you're going to be giving children antibiotics anyway, because these are the children that you're worried about in terms of sepsis. So when we use catheters for micturating cystograms, we always give children prophylactic antibiotics to cover the risk of introducing infection. Mm. But when you're thinking of doing a catheter for this purposes, we're going to be giving these children antibiotics anyway because of our concern about their sepsis. So,
okay. So if we've got the clean catch urine, can we just talk about what we expect to see on dipstick?
Yeah. So again, and I think that's another area where there's some confusion. And where some of the misdiagnoses come in. So in terms of diagnosing UTIs on dipstick, we look at nitrites and leukocytes. Mm-hmm. You sometimes see a bit of blood, you sometimes see a bit of protein, but actually those don't help with your diagnosis of a UTI. Mm-hmm. In terms of the leukocytes and nitrites, if you've got both positive, then that's, you know, essentially confirms a mm-hmm. UTI. If you've got one positive, then you know, the NICE guideline says different things about the number of positive elements on a dipstick at different ages of children. I think in reality, if you've got one positive and you've got a history that fits with a UTI, I would treat them as a UTI and send your urine sample off anyway to confirm it. If you've got neither positive, then that makes a UTI unlikely. Mm. There are some concerns that the younger the child, the less reliable dipsticks are. So, you know, I think if you really don't have another focus of infection and the dipstick's negative, I think I'd still encourage doctors to send a urine for microscopy and culture. Mm.
Yeah, because it says on the pathway here in the Wessex Healthy Together management sheet about sending all samples for culture in all children under 3 years of age, even if you're nitrite and leukocyte negative. Why is the dipstick negative sometimes?
So there's an understanding that leukocytes come from obviously inflammation within your urinary tract, so you can get some false positives with that. So if a child's got balanitis or a girl's got vulvovaginitis, then that can give you raised white cells. Similarly, we do see raised white cells in children that have a fever. So even if they've got an upper respiratory tract infection, you can still have some leukocytes in your urine without it being a UTI. So you can get some false positives. Mm-hmm. You can also get some false negatives in that the leukocytes lies with storage. So if it's not a fresh sample, then the white cells just break down in the sample and you get a false negative.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
And then nitrites are formed by the bacterial action and turning nitrate into nitrite, and it's thought that the urine sample needs to be within the bladder for a period of about an hour in order for that conversion to take place. Mm-hmm. So particularly in younger children where they're weeing more continually, you might not get time for the nitrates, for the bacteria to work on the nitrates.
Okay.
So you may still get a negative thing. And obviously there's not the same volume of urine in a baby as well. So I think for those reasons and the fact that you don't get as many localising signs to back up your clinical suspicions in babies, the encouragement is to send send samples.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when we've got the clean catch urine and we send it to the lab, we're sending it for microscopy and for culture and sensitivity. Mm. So we're going to get the microscopy back first. And what would we expect to see in UTI?
So we're looking for white cells. So I guess every lab will have their own parameters. Here in Dorchester, a white cell count of more than 40 on the urine would imply that's raised and that there's a high chance that that's secondary to a UTI. But frequently we're seeing them in the, 200-300s or more.
Yeah, okay. And does that correlate with the severity or not necessarily?
I don't think so particularly, no.
Okay. And then obviously we have to wait for a couple of days for results to come back. So we want to confirm.
So we're ideally looking for a pure growth of one bacteria. So mixed growths tend to imply contamination.
Okay.
So we're looking for a pure growth and anything generally around 10 to the 8 colony forming units per mil is consistent with it being a UTI.
Okay.
So if you've got that and you've got the raised white cells on your lab tests, then that's really the kind of confirmation that this is a urinary tract infection.
Okay, we've definitely got a confirmed UTI based on that. Is there a problem with delaying the treatment until we get that result?
I think that depends upon your clinical suspicions. It depends upon the age of the child and how sick they are. So as you're aware, when we get babies in, we would give them antibiotics, IV antibiotics straight away, treating them for sepsis whilst we're waiting for urine results to come back alongside blood cultures and CSF cultures. If you've got an older child where you're fairly clear from the history that the child has a UTI, then yes, treat with appropriate antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And providing, it's an older child and they're not vomiting, then oral antibiotics are just as good.
Mm.
And if you've got a low suspicion of a UTI and maybe you've only got either a positive nitrites or a positive leukocytes, I'd be sending those for culture and sensitivity, but perhaps waiting until you've got some early results on that back if the child's not too unwell and if it's not clear, because what we don't want is to diagnose them as a UTI, treat them, but miss that actually this might not be a UTI.
Yeah, sure.
As I said, particularly with leukocytes only positive, we do see that in children that have febrile illnesses not related to UTIs. So you don't want to just get a positive leukocyte dipstick and say, yes, this child's got a UTI, and miss the fact that they may have something else going on.
A positive urine dip doesn't necessarily mean a UTI if it's only white cells, and especially if there are, say, respiratory symptoms.
Yeah. I think as long as you're putting together the whole picture of whether the child has urinary symptoms as well, then I think that's important. And certainly on those cases, sometimes you see a bit of blood or a bit of protein in the way with children who don't have UTIs and they have other upper respiratory tract infection, I guess, is classic, isn't it? On those occasions, I would encourage GPs to repeat the urine dipstick in a couple of weeks once the child is well and ensure that there is no ongoing kind of persistent hematuria or low-grade proteinuria. And one would expect when the child is better and over the acute illness that the dipstick turns to normal.
So, and that all that advice correlates exactly with what we've got on the Healthier Together pathway here, the red, amber and green high-risk, intermediate and low-risk groups. So that's great. Okay, so with a child who's got a UTI or a suspected UTI, what would you expect to find on examination? Is there anything we should particularly look for in terms of signs?
Yeah, well, I think the NICE guideline nicely splits UTIs into upper and lower tract UTIs. So lower tract UTIs are more of a kind of cystitis type thing. So they give you... they don't make you systemically unwell, so you tend not to have a significant fever. The child doesn't tend to be particularly unwell in themselves, but maybe has a bit of dysuria or a bit of hesitancy frequency, maybe a bit of wetting, without being systemically unwell. And you wouldn't expect to see a huge amount on examination from those children. And then the opposite to that is upper tract UTIs. So by definition in babies, they're going to have an upper tract UTI by the time you realise that something's wrong. They're going to present with, as we said, non-specifically with fever, with vomiting.
Mm.
So you're wanting to examine the child and take their temperature, you know, make an assessment on the basis of sepsis in terms of their heart rate and their capillary refill and assessment like that. Thinking more from a renal point of view, wanting to make sure that they're not constipated, because that's one of the commonest causes of urinary tract infection is poor bladder emptying secondary to constipation. So make sure that you palpate their abdomen and feel for that. Again, making sure that there's no palpable abdominal masses going on, either a bladder or an enlarged kidney if they've got some underlying structural renal disease. And also examining their spine and their lower limb reflexes. Again, if you've got spina bifida, you've got poor bladder emptying. So it's important to think of that as well in your examination of a child. And then also thinking in terms of kind of more chronic renal impairment, thinking of about the child's growth and plotting their height and weight and making sure that they're not failing to thrive, and checking their blood pressure.
Okay, great. So we've got a positive urine dip. We've confirmed our diagnosis. Let's move on to treatment. How are we going to treat this UTI?
So antibiotics, and obviously refer people to the Wessex Healthy Together and the peer antibiotic guidelines, and any local variations on that. For babies under 3 months, we would recommend that they're admitted to hospital and receive intravenous antibiotics. As we said, by the nature of it, these will be upper tract infections. IV ceftriaxone or ceftriaxone, depending upon the age of the baby, and also considering a stat dose of gentamicin if the child is septic, or if there's a known structural abnormality of the renal tract. In older children, the recommendation is if they've got upper tract UTIs, then a kind of 7 to 10 day course of antibiotics, and that can be oral if they're tolerating those. And if it's a lower tract UTI, then usually a 3 day course of trimethoprim is adequate.
So if you've got a successfully treated UTI, why do they sometimes come back?
So we know, depending on the studies that you read, about 50% of children with a UTI will have an underlying structural abnormality.
Okay, that's quite a lot.
So, and obviously the younger the child is, the more likely that is to be the case. If a child's got to the age of 10, for example, that without ever having a UTI before, they're unlikely to have a significant abnormality of their kidneys. And when we come on to talk about imaging, that's why the kind of imaging guidance varies depending upon the age of the child, because we're looking for underlying renal tract abnormalities. But we also know that there are certain risk factors for recurrent UTIs, and one of the biggest one is incomplete bladder emptying. So these are children that perhaps are constipated, where you're not getting the same bladder emptying because of the pressure from the loaded bowel. Children that we said with spina bifida or neuropathic bladders that don't empty their bladder as effectively. Children that just don't drink enough, so they're not flushing any bugs that are there through effectively, or children that are kind of got poor toileting habits. So one of the you often see a spike of incidences of UTIs around the time that children are potty training, or that type children start school, just because you don't get the same toileting habits, and so children are holding on, they're maybe not emptying their bladder as fully as they could do.
So there is an element of training or retraining.
Yeah, so certainly talking through simple things like making sure that children are drinking enough fluids. So ideally between 6 to 8 cups a drink a day. And one of the nice things with describing it in cups is cups are generally sized according to the age of the child. So, you know, if you go to the local supermarket, your toddler will want a Bob the Builder cup, which is a certain volume. When your child gets older, they want a Star Wars cup, which is a bit bigger, because it's aimed at slightly older children. So trying to say 6 to 8 cups is good, and it's also easy to give that as a prescription to parents. And so what I say is have 2 cups of drink with every meal, and then have one cup at kind of morning playtime at school and one cup when you get home from school.
Yeah.
And then that's your six cups in. It also means that you're not then drinking lots in the evening, which helps for those children that have issues with bed wetting.
And those two things can be linked anyway, can't they?
If you certainly if your bladder's not working properly, then yes, it will predispose you to wetting day and night, and also UTIs. And that's why we try and encourage people to get into good habits with their bladder. Of drinking plenty, but then also making sure that they wee regularly and they empty their bladder fully each time that they go.
Great. So let's talk about imaging, if that's okay.
So it's interesting how kind of imaging guidelines have changed over time, and certainly when the NICE guidelines first came out, I know there was quite a lot of discussion and debate about whether it had gone too far in terms of cutting back the number of investigations that we do. And I was involved in an audit when I was a registrar in Southampton that looked at the new guidelines compared to the old ones, and we realised that actually we wouldn't have missed children with structural abnormalities, which was the thing that everybody was anxious about.
So how, in what way did they change?
So I can remember way back when I was in SHA, every child that got a UTI, had a UTI got an ultrasound, a micturating cystogram and a DMSA scan, pretty much, you know, irrespective of their age. Whereas now we are a bit more thoughtful about what investigations we do, and obviously trying to balance up the pros and cons of invasive and expensive investigations versus the kind of benefits to diagnosing that a child has an underlying renal tract abnormality, where you might be able to change the course of that by adequately managing that and preventing further infections.
Okay, so who would get an ultrasound scan?
So, I mean, I think from a podcast point of view, my advice would be for people that are thinking about this is to look at the NICE guidelines rather than kind of memorise things and look at it each time. But you're right that NICE splits it into what they call simple UTIs. So those are children that don't have any kind of complicating features to it. They respond well to first line antibiotics. There's nothing abnormal on the examination in terms of palpable bladders or abnormal creatinines. And if they're below 6 months then of age, then they get an ultrasound. Otherwise, with a simple UTI, you wouldn't get any imaging recommended. And then NICE talk about recurrent UTIs, which they say are two or more upper tract UTIs. What isn't clear is over what time frame that has to be. You know, if you have a UTI at 6 months and then a UTI when you're 16, that's two. But you wouldn't necessarily investigate from that point of view. And so I think that needs a bit of common sense applied. And then NICE also talks about atypical UTIs. So those are ones where the child is seriously ill, where there's abnormalities on examination to make you think that there might be an underlying cause. Perhaps they've got some renal impairment or a non-E. coli organism, because most organisms causing UTIs in children are E. coli, but we know that if you've got a structural abnormality, you're more likely to have Proteus or another infection.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. I think that really clarifies some of my questions, actually, about imaging. And it's just really good advice to always just go back to the NICE guidelines. And there is a nice clear table there. So I think we've covered a lot of ground today and really useful stuff. So thanks for that. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add? Just any thoughts or messages that for those of us working in primary or secondary care?
So I think the key parts are make sure that you get the right diagnosis, make sure that you get a urine sample, because that's the only way of diagnosing a UTI is with a urine sample, particularly in younger children where you don't get the localising signs. And make sure that you interpret the results of your dipstick correctly in terms of looking at nitrites and leukocytes, but appreciating the false positives and false negatives of those. And then the value of sending off a sample for microscopy and culture, I think, is really important, because it confirms whether the child has had a UTI and also gives you some sensitivity patterns that you know, are useful if the child goes on to have recurrent urinary tract infections.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of resources for GPs and paediatricians in general, the NICE guidelines on UTI, the Healthier Together pathway on UTI, there's also a really good paediatric nephrology website called InfoKid. InfoKid.org has got a section on UTIs, but also on congenital abnormalities of kidneys, which may be useful. And then the ERIC website is fantastic from a constipation and wetting point of view, and gives lots of advice on toileting and kind of bladder gym in terms of drinking lots, weeing lots, and lots of resources on there.
And they're, well, definitely the ERIC, and I think the InfoKid as well, but they're also good for parents and carers to look at as well.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely.
Really accessible.
Yeah, no, definitely, they're really accessible and great resources. The ERIC one has a little wee and a little poo character that you know, even aimed at children themselves, so that's ideal. And then I think just as a kind of summary, the NICE guidelines came up with some quality standards, which I think are useful kind of things to bear in mind. So the first is that all children with an unexplained fever of over 38 should have a urine tested within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the key parts are the unexplained fever. If the child's clearly got a source of infection, then we shouldn't be testing urine in those children, because, as we said, you can sometimes get misleading dipsticks that then might lead you to unnecessarily investigate children. But if they've got a truly unexplained fever, then a urine sample is essential. Children with UTI, the second quality standards, children with UTIs should have risk factors for UTIs and serious pathology recorded. So that's the thinking about previous UTIs, whether there's been any antenatal diagnosis of urinary tract abnormalities, any family history of renal disease, and then thinking about things like constipation and dysfunctional voiding, so wetting and urgency and frequency, evidence of spinal lesions and spina bifida, checking for blood pressure and stuff like that. So having that kind of holistic view and not just leaving it at diagnosing and treating this one-off episode. The third quality standard, I think, is more for the labs in terms of differentiating positive results into E. coli and non-E. coli. Again, just so that we can think about those atypical infections. And the fourth one is that children with UTIs should be given information about reducing the risks of recurrent UTIs and how to seek advice if parents are concerned that they have got a UTI. And then that's where, you know, the parent information leaflets on the Healthier Together come into play, and the ERIC website as well.
Really useful information there. Thank you, Phil. And I think that brings our session to a close. Thank you for your time. Thank you for all the great resources that you've shared. I'm sure we'll all go away and look at them and make use of them. And I've really enjoyed chatting to you today. So thank you for joining me on Fontanelle.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.